Accession number 17771, Reel 1.
Where were you born, please?
I was born in the Cromwell Road in London on 6th of December 1924.
Can you tell me something about your family background, please? Because I think it relates to the Commonwealth.
Yes, my father was an Australian who, when he left school, went into the business of shipbuilding, and he was sent across to England in about 1905 or 6 to be apprenticed on the Tyne. My mother, who was a New Zealander, was, perhaps unusually for those times, sent over to Cheltenham Ladies' College when she was 15, and spent all her school days here in England. And my mother and father met on ship going home and constantly got married. And my father returned to this country just before World War I and served for 4 years as an engineer in the Royal Flying Corps. And at the end of the war, stayed here, and my twin sister and I were born in 1924. I initially went to school in this country, although we made various trips out to see our relatives in Australia and New Zealand. But in 1940, we returned to New Zealand because my father by that time was an invalid. He was a chronic asthmatic, and there were, in those days, very few clever drugs to deal with asthmatics. It meant that he, could not wear a gas mask, and of course in 1940 everybody expected Hitler to use gas. So we went back to New Zealand, where I went to school, at a school called Whanganui Collegiate School, which was one of the three very similar to our British public schools. By the time I was 17, I was fairly bored with being in New Zealand. I think, like all young men of that age, one has sort of grandiose ideas. I was very much a child of London. I'd been born there and had great affinity to London, and had sat out the first little bit of the war not very happily out in New Zealand, because I really wanted to get home and join up. And finally, in April 1942, when I was just 17 and a bit, I managed to persuade my parents and the New Zealand government to let me come home, which I did by sea, arriving in England in the beginning of April 42.
In those early years of the war in New Zealand, to what extent did the New Zealand population feel it was their war, even though it was so remote?
Oh, tremendously so. I mean, in both world wars, both the New Zealanders and the Australians sent enormous numbers of troops across to this country to fight. When the Japanese came into the war, of course, there was a feeling that perhaps their troops were needed back in New Zealand or Australia, but the Japanese were stopped a long time before they got any further south. And in fact, I think bombing Darwin was about as close as they ever came. But there were Japanese raiders out in the South Pacific. And in fact, when I came to sail back to this country via the Panama Canal, we did in fact go an awful long way south before we got to the Panama Canal in order to avoid any such thing.
Did you ever come across anybody who had a contrary attitude, that it was nothing to do with New Zealand?
Absolutely not, at all. I mean, in those days, and indeed for some time after the war, if a New Zealander talked about going home, he didn't actually mean going to his farmstead, he actually meant going to England. And they were the most tremendous supporters, and I regarded myself as a part New Zealander, Australian and Briton. I mean, there was no difference between us. It always rather irks me that today I actually have to have a visa to go to Australia, which was my father's homeland. But, you know, times have changed since the war.
When you arrived in England, what did you find from the war point of view?
Well, the first thing that happened to me, of course, was that I had actually been at Radley College before we went out to New Zealand in 1940. I had been sent over, and my guardians were my aunt and uncle, my uncle also being my godfather, And he quite wisely sent me back to Radley for one term. It was quite interesting. The house that I'd originally been in had been taken over by Eastbourne College, which had been moved from the south coast, which was fairly dangerous, and the whole of Eastbourne College was billeted on our school at Radley. But apart from that, I then found that although I had already been intended to join the Royal Navy most of my life, I decided that I could actually join the Royal Air Force rather quicker than I could the Royal Navy. And through the good offices of my school, I got an entry into Oxford University. I had matriculated out in New Zealand. And the Air Force had got a really rather splendid scheme, which they operated during the latter part of the war, whereby you went up to one of the universities, you did 6 months with the University Air Squadron, 6 months as an ordinary undergraduate, and at the end of that time you took university exams, which if you passed entitled you to return after the war, and your 6 months with the University Air Squadron counted as the first part of your training. In other words, if you'd done that, you didn't go to the initial training wing, which all Air Force entries did, or aircrew did in those days. So I went up to Oxford in October 1942 to read history and join the University Air Squadron, and it was a very valuable and fascinating time of my life. I had always been interested in history, so that was no problem. But also, I think one grew up quite a lot, as even at that early age, I mean, 17 these days is scarcely the age that one goes to university.
What kind of experiences and training did you get with the University Air Squadron?
Well, it was mainly sort of ground school, mainly sort of navigation, airmanship, theory of flight, and all that sort of thing. But there were Tiger Moths based at Abingdon Airfield, and we used to get a certain amount of flying on Tiger Moths there, but not a lot, 5-10 hours, I would suppose. But we got all the drill and all that side of life, and so that when we finished, we were then sent to the aircrew reception centre at St John's Wood, where all aircrew were funnelled through to be kitted out and have all our jabs and eyesight testing and all the rest of it. And so we had a fair amount of idea of what the Air Force was all about. And so our few weeks at ACRC, as it was called, was not too difficult.
Was the war affecting Oxford very much?
Oh, yes. You either had very mature students or very young students like we were. The sort of the 20-year-olds were away in the war. So it was not a highly populated university in those days, but from our point of view that perhaps had certain advantages. More notice was perhaps taken of us than if we'd been one of the 5,000 or whatever the university generally has. The tutors were all the same, and so really apart from blackout and things of that nature and the usual rationing, life went on remarkably as ever.
And the effect on the town?
Didn't seem to be any. I mean, no, there didn't seem. Oxford was never bombed, so it escaped anything of that. It wasn't part of the Baedeker raids or anything like that. So it came fairly unscathed.
And what was the next step in your career?
Well, after we'd finished ACRC, by that time of the war, this was by then the beginning of 1943, the Air Force had introduced what they called the PNB scheme. That was Pilot Navigator Bomb Aimer scheme. And all aircrew trainees, who were incidentally in those days, were classified as leading aircraftsmen and paid accordingly. We were distinguished from the ordinary airmen by wearing a white flash in our hats. Everybody went on this Pilot Navigator Bomb Aimer scheme. You went to a training school and did up to 12 hours of flying, at the end of which you had a flying examination, and then depending on the requirements for the various categories, you were allocated willy-nilly into one of those categories. So having completed, I went to an airfield near Derby called Burniston, where we did our flying training in Tiger Moss, which was most enjoyable. I wasn't too bad. I soloed at 6 hours and very much enjoyed the experience. However, we were then all sent. There was a big reception centre up at Heaton Park in Manchester. All air crew, having completed that, were sent up there. And then we always remember we were assembled in the sort of what was the camp cinema. And then some officer got up and read out our names and told us which category we were getting. And I was made a navigator. I suppose I must have been disappointed. Everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot in those days, but not bitterly so. I was then fairly fortunate because everybody gathered there waited for convoys to take them either to Canada or to South Africa, where, because the vast majority of training by then was done in North America, Rhodesia and South Africa. There was always a delay on shipping, depending on losses, and of course 1942-43 was an exceptionally bad time for sinkings in the Atlantic. We spent a period of 3 weeks at Ludlow in Shropshire, digging ditches and living in tents. It was summer, as a sort of a delay, but when that was over, I was remarkably lucky. It was, I was actually trained in the United Kingdom and didn't have to go abroad. My great friend from Oxford University, who had joined up the same time as I had, he was sent for flying training into Canada, and he actually ended up the war by flying a Liberator into India after VJ Day. But of course I was much speedier. I went to Bridgnorth, which was a ground school for navigators, and then to Northern Ireland, where I trained at number 7 Air Observer School, where we trained on Anson Mark 1s, did about, I suppose, 50 hours flying round the Irish Sea, etc., and learning how the basics of air navigation. And from there, and by this time it would have been early 1944, I was sent to an operational training unit on Wellington's at an airfield called Enstone in Oxfordshire.
Why was your preference for training in England rather than...
Well, it wasn't my preference. It was just the way it happened. I have no idea why. I was just lucky. Because I think if I had been sent overseas, I would not have seen any action in the war. Whereas, having completed the OTU at Enstone, I was then sent up to Marston Moor in Yorkshire for heavy conversion unit onto Halifax's. We had already crewed up at Enstone. And I think that the crewing system which developed in Bomber Command during the war was really remarkable from, I think, a clever and psychological point of view, because we were allowed to select our own crews. We all got together. I suppose there must have been nearly 50 or so of us. And one sort of met in the bar and... although I was, of course, a sergeant in those days, I wasn't an officer. And we sort of picked each other. And I was chosen by a pilot officer, Australian, who was wearing Australian uniforms, because the Australians and New Zealanders wore their own uniform and badges of rank, etc. And he and I agreed to crew up. We selected a bomb aimer who, of course, went by the name of Shorty Wells because he was 6'4". He was English. We had a Welsh rear gunner called Taffy House, who came from Cardiff. Barry Docks, in fact. And he was a great little chap. We had a flight engineer who was rather older than most of us. He had been a pre-war speedway rider. And we didn't have second pilots in those days. The bomb aimer acted as the second pilot on the four-engine aircraft in those days. And we also had an English mid-upper gunner. So this sort of fairly motley bunch, then set off training originally on Wellingtons. And then when we finished on Wellingtons, and your passing out parade, as it were, was to fly a leaflet operation over occupied France. And once you completed that, you then went off to your heavy conversion unit.
If the crewing up system had been different, and if it had been directed by somebody from an office, what do you think the result of that would have been in comparison with this free and easy method?
Well, I don't think it would have been nearly as successful. You didn't have an awful lot of time to make up your minds, but at least you had some sort of rapport with the people that you were asking to join your crew. I mean, the crew in a bomber command aeroplane was absolutely crucial to success or failure. They had to be knit together as a bunch of people who knew and understood each other. And so when things went wrong, as they quite often could or did, there was sort of natural responses amongst them. I think if people had been selected and said, you, you, and you, I mean, it wouldn't have been a failure, it would have worked all right, but it wouldn't have been so satisfactory. And there was a psychological point that since you had made the selection, it was then up to you to make it work, and you couldn't blame anybody else for it. And it was something that went on throughout the entire war, as far as I know, and worked extremely successfully.
With these different types of aircraft, what did you think of flying in, say, the Wellington and Halifax?
Well, the Wellington was a remarkable aeroplane, but of course by early 1944 it was no longer operational in bomber command. It was all the four-engine heavies, but it had played a great role, and it was, of course, one of the great designs of Barnes-Wallace, with this strange geodetic construction. And it had worked extremely well, but it wasn't big enough or powerful enough to carry the sort of bomb loads which the Lancasters and the Halifaxes could carry.
And the Halifax?
Oh, the Halifax was a great aeroplane. It didn't have the long range or the carrying capacity of the Lancaster, but it was an extremely solid piece of Handley Page engineering and could take remarkable punishment and survive, probably more so than the Lancaster. And it carried a reasonable bomb load. I suppose on the longer raids we would carry about 12,000 pounds of bombs, which was pretty adequate. But of course the Lancaster had the ability to carry 12,000 pounders and ultimately the great 22,000 pound Grand Slam bomb, which only a few aircraft were modified to carry, but did remarkable work sinking the Tirpitz, the Dortmund Ems canals and things of that nature. The Halifax couldn't do that, but it could carry a mixed load of 1 4,000 pounder and a number of 500 or 1,000 pound bombs or senderies. And certainly the last mark which the squadron got before the end of the war, which was the Mark 6 with an uprated Hercules engine, was really quite a powerful aeroplane and could fly probably faster and higher than even the Lancasters.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you recounting the progress of your training.
Oh, right, yes. Well, we went up to Marston Moor, which was a heavy conversion unit just southwest of York. The problem with HCUs, of course, is that they had the leftover aircraft from the squadrons. The Halifax had started life as a Mark II and a Mark V with Merlin engines, and only with the Mark III and later the Mark VI did it go on to the more powerful Hercules engine, which was a radial engine. And the twos and fives that we were flying on the OCU were, to put it mildly, fairly clapped out. And we did lose a couple of crews, largely on crashes on takeoff with engine failure, even during the short time that I was on the unit. In fact, I remember one night having to fly sort of almost straight and level on takeoff for about 15 miles before we managed to get sufficient speed on to climb. and they were not very good and reliable aeroplanes, but majority of us all survived. Following HCU, we were then posted to our operational squadron. And again, I think I was fairly fortunate. I was posted to a small airfield just south of Selby in Yorkshire called Burn, and on to a squadron 578, which was a fairly newly formed squadron. It had been formed in February of 1944. By this time, it was June 1944, just after D-Day. And it had been formed out of another squadron, 51, which was based further south than we were. It was a single base with a single squadron. Most Bomber Command airfields actually contained more than one squadron, but this one only had one. It was a entirely wartime base with a few hangars and Nissen huts and all the rest of it, so fairly basic. But it made for a very matey and cohesive outfit. So much so that even today, all these years later, there is still an annual reunion of the RAF 578 Burn Association, because we don't just have aircrew on the association, we have anybody who served at the airfield during those times. I mean, the squadron's history only lasted for some 14 months, because we were disbanded in March of 1945, because at that time the Air Force wanted more mosquito squadrons, and the Treasury wouldn't allow more mosquito squadrons until some of the heavy squadrons had been disbanded. And so we were, you know, last in, first out. And we were then dispersed to another squadron, and I joined 158 Squadron on the East Coast at a place called Lissett near Bridlington.
Can you take me through the operations that you did, the ones that stick out in your mind, please, what it was like on operations?
Yeah. I was fortunate, of course, by the time, being the age I was, by the time I joined a bomber squadron, the losses had come down quite considerably. The dangerous time for aircrew was in 1942-43, when losses in Bomber Command were really very heavy. In fact, when you look back and you realize that during the war, 57,000 aircrew died in Bomber Command, it gives an idea of what it was like. By the time I was on the squadron, the losses had gone down considerably. It was a very good squadron to join. We had a remarkable young CO, Wing Commander David Wilkerson. In fact, it was really only after the war. I mean, I was, 19 by then. It was only after the war that I remembered this great figure of our CO, who was only actually 26 years old at the time. He was on his second or third tour of operations. He'd been sent to work up this brand new squadron and had been told fairly forcibly that he was not to fly on too many operations. But David Wilkerson was not that sort of man. He led from the front. And it was sad to say that he was taken off operations about 3 months after I joined the squadron, sent to a Boston day bomber OCU, and as a passenger in an aeroplane, just 3 months after he left the squadron, he was killed in a flying accident. But he was a remarkable man, because he regarded every member of his crews as part of his family. And even as a very young man, as so many of us were, we were nurtured through the early days of our operations. It was generally held, and I think quite true, that perhaps it was your first 5 to 10 operations which were the most dangerous ones, when you were fairly naive and hadn't much experience. The only experience the crew had of operations is that the pilots always flew one sortie with another crew as second pilot before we actually did an operation ourselves. Our introduction to operations was extremely gentle. It was the time of the battles on the beachheads in Norway and around Caen.
In Normandy.
In Normandy. And there was, in the breakout, there was a concentration of German armour in what was known as the Falaise Gap. And in order to help the breakout, Bomber Command was brought up to go and bomb the panzer divisions. So our first operation was a daylight operation against this concentration of German armour just over the coast in France, where there was not a great deal of opposition to us. There was no, I remember, recall no fighters, a certain amount of flak, so it was quite an easy way to cut one's teeth. Also, the V1 threat, of course, was hitting England, and quite a lot of our early operations were against these V1 targets in northern France and the Low Countries, which were, again, were very short penetration raids, almost entirely in daylight, and therefore not dangerous like the longer trips into the Ruhr. But that was... So we had a fairly easy introduction. Later on, of course, we then, as the days grew shorter and the nights longer, we reverted back to attacking oil and other targets, and so we started attacking the Ruhr again, Kiel, I remember, cities like Magdeburg, and a number of marshalling yards in Germany. Again, we were a very fortunate crew in the fact that we were never attacked by a night fighter, and although we got occasional damage from flak, we were never badly damaged. The loss rate, too, as I said before, was going down, and during my time of the squadron, not very many crews were lost. So it wasn't, as it were, a very difficult period in comparison with what had gone before. We lost our Australian pilot from the simple business of him falling off a bicycle at night and breaking his wrist. That may, in fact, not have been a bad thing from our point of view, although we liked him. He was a 30-year-old, not a remarkably good pilot, and so it wasn't a great loss from our point of view. And we were sent another pilot who was very experienced. He'd done one tour of operations. He'd been an instructor on the heavy conversion unit at Rickall, and so he came to us with a lot of experience. He was also an extremely nice man, and the only married member of our crew. He was rather older than we were. So we settled down very happily with this chap, whose name was Norman Garforth, until we had a very, very unfortunate experience. In order to practice crews against night fighters, there was a Thames Spitfire that used to travel round all the various bomber stations, and one used to go off and do fighter affiliation, practice the standard corkscrews, which was the sort of evasive action that was, which was considered the best way of avoiding fighters. And so, one afternoon in early January 1945,